was still on the ground, her mission just to empty the answering machine attached to the phone. The number 21 had been in the gadget's window. Messages 1 through 17 and 19 through 21 had been from the sort of hucksters Scott had called phone lice. The 18th, this didn't surprise Lisi at all, had been from Amanda. "Just wanted to know if you ever hooked this damn thing up," she said. "You gave me and Darla and Canty the number before Scott died." Pause. "I guess you did." Pause. "Hook it up, I mean." Pause. Then, in a rush, "But there was a very long time between the message and the bleep, sheesh. You must have a lot of messages on there, little Lisi. You ought to check the damn things in case somebody wants to give you a set of spode or something." Pause. "Well, goodbye." Now, standing outside the closed office door, feeling pain pulse in sync with her heartbeat behind her right eye, she listened to the telephone ring a third time and a fourth. Halfway through the fifth ring, there was a click, and then her own voice telling whoever was on the other end that he or she had reached 727-5932. There was no false promise of a callback, not even an invitation to leave a message at the sound of what Amanda called the bleep. Anyway, what would be the point? Who would call here to talk to her? With Scott dead, the motor was out of this place. The one left was really just little Lisi DeBuscher from Lisbon Falls, now the widow Landon. Little Lisi lived alone in a house far too big for her, and wrote grocery lists, not novels. The pause between the message and the beep was so long that she thought the tape for replies had to be full. Even if it wasn't, the caller would get tired and hang up. All she'd hear through the closed office door would be that most annoying of recorded phone voices, the woman who tells you, scolds you, "If you'd like to make a call, please hang up and dial your operator." She doesn't add smuckhead or shit for brains, but Lisi always sensed it as what Scott would have called a subtext. Instead, she heard a male voice speak three words. There was no reason for them to chill her, but they did. "I'll try again," it said. There was a click, and then there was silence. 8. This is a much nicer present, she thinks, but knows it's neither past nor present. It's just a dream. She was lying on the big double bed in the our bedroom under the slowly paddling fan. In spite of the 130 milligrams of caffeine in the 2 Excedrin, expiration date October 07, she took from the dwindling supply of Scott meds in the bathroom cabinet, she had fallen asleep. If she has any doubt of it, she only has to look at where she is, the third floor ICU wing of the Nashville Memorial Hospital, and her unique means of travel. She's once more locomoting on a large piece of cloth with the words Pillsbury's Best Flower printed on it. Once more, she's delighted to see that the corners of this homely magic carpet, where she sits with her arms regally folded beneath her bosom, are knotted like hankies. She's floating so close to the ceiling that when Pillsbury's Best Flower slips beneath one of the slowly paddling overhead fans, in her dream they look just like the one in their bedroom. She has to lie flat to avoid being whacked and cracked by the blades. These varnished wooden oars say shup, 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 over and over as they make their slow and somehow stately revolutions. Below her, nurses come and go on squeaking-soled shoes. Some are wearing the colorful smocks that will come to dominate the profession, but most of these still wear white dresses, white hose, and those caps that always make Lisi think of stuffed doves. Two doctors, she supposes they must be doctors, although one doesn't look old enough to shave, chat by the drinking fountain. The tile walls are cool green. The heat of the day cannot seem to take hold in here. She supposes there is air conditioning as well as the fans, but she can't hear it. "Not in my dream, of course not," she tells herself. And this seems reasonable. Up ahead is room 319, which is where Scott went to recuperate after they took the bullet out of him. She has no trouble reaching the door, but discovers she's too high to get through once she arrives. And she wants to get in there. She never got around to telling him, "You can take care of the rest of this mess later." But was that even necessary? Scott Landon did not, after all, fall off a hayrick yesterday. The real question, it seems to her, is what's the correct magic word to make a magic Pillsbury's Best carpet go down? It comes to her. It's not a word she wants to hear emerging from her mouth. It's a Blondie word. But needs must when the devil drives, as Dandy also said. And so? Freesias, Lisi says, and the faded cloth with the knotted corners obediently drops 3 feet from its hover point below the hospital ceiling. She looks in the open door and sees Scott, now maybe 5 hours post-op, lying in a narrow but surprisingly pretty bed with a gracefully curved head and foot. Monitors that sound like answering machines queep and bleep. 2 bags of something transparent hang on a pole between him and the wall. He appears to be asleep. Across the bed from him, 1988 Lisi sits in a straight-backed chair with her husband's hand folded into one of her own. In 1988, Lisi's other hand is the paperback novel she brought to Tennessee with her. She never expected to get through so much of it. Scott reads people like Borges, Pynchon, Tyler, and Atwood. Lisi reads Maeve Binchy, Colleen McCullough, Jean Ahl, although she's growing a bit impatient with Miss Ahl's randy cave people, Joyce Carol Oates, and just lately, Shirley Conran. What she has in room 319 is Savages, the newest novel by the latter, and Lisi likes it a lot. She has come to the part where the women stranded in the jungle learn to use their bras as slingshots. All that lycra. Lisi doesn't know if the romance readers of America are ready for this latest from Miss Conran, but she herself thinks it's brave and rather beautiful in its way. Isn't bravery always sort of beautiful? The last light of the day pours through the room's window in a flood of red and gold. It's ominous and lovely. 1988 Lisi is very tired, emotionally, physically, and of being in the South. She thinks if one more person calls her y'all, she'll scream. The good part? She doesn't think she's going to be here as long as they do, because, well, she has reason to know Scott's a fast healer. Leave it at that. Soon she'll go back to the motel and try to rent the same room they had earlier in the day. Scott almost always rents them a hideout, even if the gig is just what he calls the old in-out. She has an idea she won't be able to do it. They treat you a lot different when you're with a man, whether he's famous or not. But the place is fairly handy to the hospital as well as to the college, and as long as she gets something there, she doesn't give a smuck. Dr. Satterwhite, who's in charge of Scott's case, has promised her she can dodge reporters by going out the back tonight and for the next few days. He says Mrs. McKinney in reception will have a cab waiting back by the cafeteria loading dock. As soon as you give her the high sign. She would have gone already, but Scott has been restless for the last hour. Satterwhite said he'd be out at least until midnight, but Satterwhite doesn't know Scott the way she does, and Lisi isn't much surprised when he begins surfacing for brief intervals as sunset approaches. Twice he has recognized her, twice he has asked her what happened, and twice she has told him that a mentally deranged person shot him. The second time he said, "Hi-o, Smuck and Silver," before closing his eyes again, and that actually made her laugh. Now she wants him to come back one more time so she can tell him she's not going back to Maine, only to the motel, and that she'll see him in the morning. All this 2006 Lisi knows, remembers, intuits, whatever. But from where she sits on her Pillsbury's Best magic carpet, she thinks, he opens his eyes, he looks at me, he says, "I was lost in the dark and you found me. I was hot, so hot, and you gave me ice." But is that really what he said? Is it really what happened? Or was that later? And if she's hiding things, hiding them from herself, why is she hiding them? In the bed, in the red light, Scott opens his eyes, looks at his wife as she reads her book. His breath doesn't scream now, but there's still a windy sound as he pulls air in as deeply as he can and half whispers, half croaks her name. The 1988 Lisi puts down her book and looks at him. "Hey, you're awake again," she says. "So here's your pop quiz. Do you remember what happened to you?" "Shot," he whispers. "Kid. Tube. Back. Hurts. You can have something for the pain in a little while, she says. For now, would you like... He squeezes her hand, telling her she can stop. Now he'll tell me he was lost in the dark and I gave him ice. 2006, Lisi thinks. But what he says to his wife, who earlier that day saved his life by braining a madman with a silver shovel, is only this. Hot, wasn't it? His tone casual. No special look. Just making conversation. Just passing the time while the red light deepens and the machines queep and bleep. And from her hover point in the doorway, 2006 Lisi sees the shudder, subtle but there, run through her younger self. Sees the first finger of her younger self's left hand lose its place in her paperback copy of Savages. I'm thinking either he doesn't remember, or he's pretending not to remember what he said when he was down, about how he could call it if he wanted to, how he could call the long boy if I wanted to be done with him, and what I said back about how he should shut up and leave it alone, that if he just shut the smuck up it would go away. I'm wondering if this is a real case of forgetting, the way he forgot that he'd been shot, or if it's more of our special forgetting, which is more like sweeping the bad shit into a box and then locking it up tight. I'm wondering if it even matters, as long as he remembers how to get better. And as she lay on her bed, and as she rides the magic carpet in the eternal present of her dream, Lisi stirred and tried to cry out to her younger self, tried to yell that it did matter. It did. Don't let him get away with it, she tried to yell. You can't forget forever. But another saying from the past occurred to her. This one from their endless games of hearts and whist at Sabbath Day Lake in the summertime. Always yelled out when some player wanted to look at discards more than a single trick deep. Leave that alone. You can't unbury the dead. You can't unbury the dead. Still, she tries one more time. With all her considerable force of mind and will, 2006 Lisi leans forward on her magic carpet and sends, He's faking. Scott remembers everything at her younger self. And for a wild moment, she thinks she's getting through. Knows she's getting through. 1988 Lisi twitches in her chair, and her book actually slides out of her hand and hits the floor with a flat clap. But before that version of herself can look around, Scott Landon stares directly at the woman hovering in the doorway, the version of his wife who will live to be his widow. He purses his lips again, but instead of making the nasty chuffing sound, he blows. It's not much of a puff. How could it be, considering what he's been through? But it's enough to send the Pillsbury's best magic carpet flying backward, dipping and diving like a milkweed pod in a hurricane. Lisi hangs on for dear life as the hospital walls rock past. But the damn thing tilts, and she's falling, and... 9. Lisi awoke sitting bolt upright on the bed with sweat drying on her forehead and underneath her arms. It was relatively cool in here, thanks to the overhead fan, but still she was as hot as a... Well, as hot as a suck oven. Whatever that is, she said, and laughed shakily. The dream was already fading to rags and tatters. The only thing she could recall with any clarity was the otherworldly red light of some setting sun. But she had awakened with a crazy certainty planted in the forefront of her mind, a crazy imperative. She had to find that smucking shovel, that silver spade. Why? She asked the empty room. She picked the clock up off the nightstand and held it close to her face, sure it would tell her an hour had gone by, maybe even two. She was astounded to see she had been asleep for exactly 12 minutes. She put the clock back on the nightstand and wiped her hands on the front of her blouse, as if she had picked up something dirty and crawling with germs. Why that thing? Never mind. It was Scott's voice, not her own. She rarely heard it with such clarity these days, but oh boy, was she ever hearing it now, loud and clear. That's none of your business. Just find it and put it where, well, you know. Of course she did. Where I can strap it on, she murmured, and rubbed her face with her hands and gave a little laugh. That's right, baby love, her dead husband agreed. Whenever it seems appropriate. Chapter 3. Lisi and the Silver Spade. Wait for the wind to change. 1. Her vivid dream did nothing at all to free Lisi from her memories of Nashville, and from one memory in particular. Gerd Allen Cole turning the gun from the lung shot, which Scott might have been able to survive, to the heart shot, which he most certainly would not. By then the whole world had slowed down, and what she kept returning to, as the tongue keeps returning to the surface of a badly chipped tooth, was how utterly smooth that movement had been, as if the gun had been mounted on a gimbal. Lisi vacuumed the parlor, which didn't need vacuuming, then did a wash that didn't half fill the machine. The laundry basket filled so slowly now that it was just her. 2 years and she still couldn't get used to it. Finally, she pulled on her old tank suit and did laps in the pool out back. 5, then 10, then 15, then 17, and winded. She clung to the lip of the shallow end with her legs trailing out behind her, panting, her dark hair clinging to her cheeks, brow, and neck like a shiny helmet. And still she saw the pale, long-fingered hand swiveling, saw the ladysmith. It was impossible to think of it as just a gun once you knew its lethal, cuntish name. Swiveling. Saw the little black hole with Scott's death tucked inside it moving left. And the silver shovel was so heavy. It seemed impossible that she could be in time, that she could outrace Cole's insanity. She kicked her feet slowly, making little splashes. Scott had loved the pool, but actually swam in it only on rare occasions. He had been a book, beer, and inner tube sort of guy. When he wasn't on the road, that was. Or in his study, writing with the music cranked. Or sitting up in the guest room rocker in the broken heart of a winter night, bundled to the chin in one of good Maud de Buscher's Afghans, 2 in the morning and his eyes wide, wide, wide as a terrible wind, one all the way down from Yellowknife, boomed outside. That was the other Scott. One went north, one went south, and oh dear, she had loved them both the same. Everything the same. "Stop it," Lisi said fretfully. "I was in time. I was, so let it go. The lung shot was all that crazy baby ever got." Yet in her mind's eye, where the past is always present, she saw the ladysmith again start its swivel, and Lisi shoved herself out of the pool in an effort to physically drive the image away. It worked, but Blondie was back again as she stood in the changing room, toweling off after a quick rinsing shower. Gerd Allen Cole was back, is back, saying, "I got to end all this ding-dong for the Frisias." In 1988, Lisi is swinging the silver spade, but this time the smucking air in Lisi time is too thick. She's going to be just an instant too late. She will see all of the second flame corsage instead of just a portion. And a black hole will also open on Scott's left lapel as his sport coat becomes his death coat. "Quit it," Lisi growled, and slung her towel in the basket. "Give it a rest." She marched back to the house nude with her clothes under her arm. That's what the high board fence all the way around the backyard was for. 2. She was hungry after her swim, famished, actually. And although it was not quite 5 o'clock, she decided on a big skillet meal. What Darla, second oldest of the de Buscher girls, would have called comfort food, and what Scott, with great relish, would have called eatin' nasty. There was a pound of ground beef in the fridge and, lurking on a back shelf in the pantry, a wonderfully nasty selection, the cheeseburger pie version of Hamburger Helper. Lisi threw it together in a skillet with the ground beef. While it was simmering, she mixed herself a pitcher of lime Kool-Aid with double sugar. By 5:20, the smells from the skillet had filled the kitchen and all thoughts of Gerd Allen Cole had left her head, at least for the time being. She could think of nothing but food. She had 2 large helpings of the Hamburger Helper casserole and 2 big glasses of Kool-Aid. When the second helping and the second glass were gone, all except for the white dregs of sugar in the bottom of the glass, she burped resoundingly and said, "I wish I had a goddamn smucking cigarette." It was true. She had rarely wanted one so badly. A Salem Light. Scott had been a smoker when they had met at the University of Maine, where he had been both a grad student and what he called the world's youngest writer in residence. She was a part-time student, that didn't last long, and a full-time waitress at Pat's Cafe downtown, slinging pizzas and burgers. She'd picked up the smoking habit from Scott, who'd been strictly a Herbert Terryton man. They'd given up the butts together, rallying each other along. That had been in 87, the year before Gerd Allen Cole had resoundingly demonstrated that cigarettes weren't the only problem a person could have with his lungs. In the years since, Lisi went for days without thinking of them, then would fall into horrible pits of craving. Yet in a way, thinking about cigarettes was an improvement. It beat thinking about, "I gotta end all this ding-dong for the Freesias," says Gerd Allen Cole with perfect fretful clarity and turns his wrists slightly, Blondie, smoothly, and Nashville, so that the smoking barrel of the Ladysmith points at the left side of Scott's chest. And smuck, here she went, doing it again. There was store-bought pound cake for dessert and Cool Whip, perhaps the apex of eatin' nasty, to put on top of it, but Lisi was too full to consider it yet. And she was distressed to find these rotten old memories returning even after she'd taken on a gutful of hot, high-calorie food. She supposed that now she had an idea of what war veterans had to deal with. That had been her only battle, but no, Lisi. "Quit it," she whispered, and pushed her plate, "No, baby love," violently away from her. Christ, but she wanted, you know better, a cigarette. And even more than a ciggy, she wanted all those memories to go, "Lisi!" That was Scott's voice, on top of her mind for a change, and so clear, she answered out loud over the kitchen table and with no self-consciousness at all. "What, hun?" "Find the silver shovel and all this crap will blow away. Like the smell of the mill when the wind swung around and blew from the south, remember?" Of course she did. Her apartment had been in the little town of Cleves Mills, just one town east of Orono. There weren't any actual mills in Cleves by the time Lisi lived there, but there had still been plenty in Old Town, and when the wind blew from the north, especially if the day happened to be overcast and damp, the stench was atrocious. Then if the wind changed, God, you could smell the ocean and it was like being born again. For a while, "wait for the wind to change" had become part of their marriage's interior language, like "strap it on" and "sawiza" and "smuck for fuck." Then it had fallen out of favor somewhere along the way, and she hadn't thought of it for years. "Wait for the wind to change," meaning, "hang on in there, baby," meaning "don't give up yet." Maybe it had been the sort of sweetly optimistic attitude only a young marriage can sustain, she didn't know. Scott might have been able to offer an informed opinion. He'd kept a journal even back then, in their early years, scuffling days, writing in it for 15 minutes each evening while she watched sitcoms or did the household accounts. And sometimes, instead of watching TV or writing checks, she watched him. She liked the way the lamplight shone in his hair and made deep triangular shadows on his cheeks as he sat there with his head bent over his loose-leaf notebook. His hair had been both longer and darker in those days, unmarked by the gray that had begun to show up toward the end of his life. She liked his stories, but she liked how his hair looked in the spill of the lamplight just as much. She thought his hair in the lamplight was its own story, he just didn't know it. She liked how his skin felt under her hand, too. Forehead or foreskin, both were good. She would not have traded one for the other. What worked for her was the whole package. "Lisi, find the shovel." She cleared the table, then stored the remaining cheeseburger pie in a Tupperware dish. She was certain she'd never eat it now that her madness had passed, but there was too much to scrape down the sink pig. How the good Mom de Busher, who still kept house in her head, would scream at waste like that. Better by far to hide it in the fridge behind the asparagus and the yogurt, where it would age quietly. And as she did these simple chores, she wondered how in the name of Jesus Mary and Jojo the Carpenter finding that silly ceremonial shovel could do anything for her peace of mind. Something about the magic properties of silver, maybe? She remembered watching some movie on the Late Show with Darla and Cantata, some supposedly scary thing about a werewolf. Only Lisi hadn't been much frightened, if at all. She thought the werewolf more sad than scary, and besides, you could tell the movie-making people were changing his face by stopping the camera every now and then to put on more makeup and then running it again. You had to give them high marks for effort, but the finished product wasn't all that believable, at least in her humble opinion. The story was sort of interesting, though. The first part took place in an English pub, and one of the old geezers drinking there said you could only kill a werewolf with a silver bullet. And had not Gerd Allen Cole been a kind of werewolf? Come on, kid, she said, rinsing off her plate and sticking it in the almost empty dishwasher. Maybe Scott could float that downriver in one of his books, but tall stories were never your department, were they? She closed the dishwasher with a thump. At the rate it was filling, she'd be ready to run the current load around July 4th. If you want to look for that shovel, just go do it. Do you? Before she could answer this completely rhetorical question, Scott's voice came again, the clear one at the top of her mind. I left you a note, baby love. Lisey froze in the act of reaching for a dish towel to dry her hands. She knew that voice, of course she did. She still heard it 3 or 4 times a week, her voice mimicking his, a little bit of harmless company in a big empty house. Only coming so soon after all this shite about the shovel. What note? What note? Lisey wiped her hands and put the towel back to air dry on its rod. Then she turned around so her back was to the sink and her kitchen lay before her. It was full of lovely summer light, and the aroma of hamburger helper a lot less yummy now that her low appetite for the stuff had been satisfied. She closed her eyes, counted to 10, then sprang them open again. Late-day summer light boomed around her, into her. Scott, she said, feeling absurdly like her big sister Amanda, half-nuts, in other words. You haven't gone ghost on me, have you? She expected no answer. Not little Lisey DeBuscher, who had cheered on the thunderstorms and sneered at the Late Show werewolf, dismissing him as just bad time-lapse photography. But the sudden rush of wind that poured in through the open window over her sink, belling the curtains, lifting the ends of her still-damp hair and bringing the heartbreaking aroma of flowers, could almost have been taken for an answer. She closed her eyes again and seemed to hear faint music, not that of the spheres, but just an old Hank Williams country tune. Goodbye, Joe, me gotta go, me oh my oh. Her arms prickled up in goosebumps. Then the breeze died away and she was just Lisey again. Not Mandy, not Canty, not Darla. Certainly not, one went south, run off to Miami Jody. She was thoroughly modern Lisey, 2006 Lisey, the widow Landon. There were no ghosts. She was Lisey alone. But she did want to find that silver spade, the one that had saved her husband for another 16 years and 7 novels. Not to mention for the Newsweek cover in 92 that had featured a psychedelic Scott with magical realism and the cult of Landon in Peter Mack's lettering. She wondered how Roger the Jackrabbit-Meal had liked them apples. Lisey decided she'd look for the spade right away, while the long light of the early summer evening still held. Ghosts or no ghosts, she didn't want to be out in the barn or the study above it once night had fallen. 3. The stalls opposite her never-quite-completed office were dark and musty affairs that had once held tools, tack, and spare parts for farm vehicles and machinery back when the Landon home had been Sugar Top Farm. The largest bay had held chickens, and although it had been swamped out by a professional cleaning company and then whitewashed by Scott, who did it with many references to Tom Sawyer, it still held the faint, ammoniac reek of long-gone fowl. It was a smell Lisey remembered from her youngest childhood and hated, probably because her Granny Dee had keeled over and died while feeding the chickens. 2 of the cubbies were stacked high with boxes, liquor store cartons for the most part, but there were no digging implements, silver or otherwise. There was a sheeted double bed in the erstwhile chicken pen, the single leftover from their brief 9-month Germany experiment. They had bought the bed in Bremen, and had shipped it back at paralyzing expense. Scott had insisted. She had forgotten all about the Bremen bed until now. Talk about what fell out of the dog's ass, Lisey thought with a kind of miserable exultation, and then said aloud, if you think I'd ever sleep in a bed after it's set 20-some years out in a goddamn chicken pen, Scott, then you're crazy, was how she meant to finish, and couldn't. She burst out laughing instead. Christ, the curse of money. The smucking curse of it. How much had that bed cost? $1,000 American? Say 1,000. And how much to ship it back? Another 1,000? Maybe. And here it sat, right cheer, Scott might have said, in the chicken shit shadows. And right cheer it could continue to sit, until the world ended in fire or ice as far as she was concerned. The whole Germany thing had been such a bust. No book for Scott, an argument with the landlord that had come within a hair of degenerating into a fistfight. Even Scott's lectures had gone badly. The audiences either had no sense of humor or didn't get his, and behind the door across the way, the one wearing the high voltage sign, the telephone began to shout again. Lisi froze where she was, feeling more goosebumps. And yet there was also a sense of inevitability, as if this was what she had come out here for, not the silver spade at all, but to take a call. She turned as the phone rang a second time and crossed the barn's dim center aisle. She reached the door as the third ring began. She thumbed the old-fashioned latch and the door opened easily, just screaming a little on its unused hinges. "Welcome to the crypt, little Lisi. We've been dying to meet you. Heh-heh-heh." A draft whooshed in around her, flapping her blouse against the small of her back. She felt for the light switch and flicked it, not sure what to expect, but the overhead went on. Of course it did. As far as Central Main Power was concerned, all of this was the study, RFD number 2, Sugar Top Hill Road. Upstairs or downstairs, to CMP, it was a clear-cut case of everything the same. The telephone on the desk rang a fourth time. Before ring number 5 could wake up the answering machine, Lisi snagged the receiver. "Hello?" There was a moment of silence. She was about to say hello again when the voice at the other end did it for her. The tone was perplexed, but Lisi recognized who it was just the same. That one word had been enough. "You knew your own." "Darla?"
"Lisi, it is you."
"Sure it's me.
Where are you?"
"Scott's old study."
"No, you're not. I already tried there."
Lisi only had to consider this briefly. Scott had liked his music loud. In truth, he liked it at levels normal people would have considered ridiculous. And the telephone up there was located in the soundproofed area he had been amused to call my padded cell. It wasn't surprising she hadn't heard it down here. None of this seemed worth explaining to her sister.
"Darla, where did you get this number, and why are you calling?"
There was another pause, then Darla said,
"I'm at Amanda's. I got the number from her book. She's got 4 for you. I just ran through all of them. This was the last."
Lisi felt a sinking sensation in her chest and stomach. As children, Amanda and Darla had been bitter rivals. They'd gotten into any number of scratching matches, over dolls, library books, clothes. The last and gaudiest confrontation had been over a boy named Richie Stanchfield, and had been serious enough to land Darla in the Central Main General ER, where 6 stitches had been needed to close the deep scratch over her left eye. She still wore the scar, a thin white dash. They got on better as adults only to this extent. There had been plenty of arguments, but no more spilled blood. They stayed out of each other's way as much as possible. The once or twice monthly Sunday dinners with spouses, or sister lunches at Olive Garden or Outback could be difficult, even with Manda and Darla sitting apart and Lisi and Canty mediating. For Darla to be calling from Amanda's house was not a good thing. "Is something wrong with her, Darl?" Dumb question. The only real question was how wrong. "Mrs. Jones heard her screaming and carrying on and breaking stuff, doing one of her big teas."
"One of her big tantrums, check."
"She tried Canty first, but Canty and Rich are in Boston. When Mrs. Jones got that message on their answering machine, she called me."
That made sense. Canty and Rich lived a mile or so north of Amanda on Route 19. Darla lived roughly 2 miles south. In a way, it was like their father's old rhyme. One went north, one went south, one couldn't shut her everlasting mouth. Lisi herself was about 5 miles away. Mrs. Jones, who lived across the road from Mandy's weather-tight little Cape Cod, would have known well enough to call Canty first, and not just because Canty was closer in terms of distance, either.
"Screaming and carrying on and breaking stuff."
"How bad is it this time?" Lisi heard herself asking in a flat, strangely businesslike tone of voice. "Should I come?" Meaning, of course, how fast should I come?
I think she's okay for now," Darla said. "But she's doing it again. On her arms. Also a couple of places high up on her thighs.
Lisi knew all right. On 3 previous occasions, Amanda had lapsed into what Jane Whitlow, her shrink, called passive semi-catatonia. It was different from what had happened, hush about that, I won't, from what had happened to Scott in 1996, but pretty damn scary all the same. And each time, the state had been preceded by bouts of excitability, the sort of excitability Amanda had been exhibiting up in Scott's study, Lisi realized, followed by hysteria, then brief spasms of self-mutilation. During one of these, Amanda had apparently tried to excise her navel. She had been left with a ghostly fairy ring of scar tissue around it. Lisi had once broached the possibility of cosmetic surgery, not knowing if it would be possible, but wanting Amanda to know she, Lisi, would be willing to pay if Amanda wanted at least to explore the possibility. Amanda had declined with a harsh caw of amusement. "I like that ring," she'd said. "If I'm ever tempted to start cutting myself again, maybe I'll look at that and stop." Maybe, it seemed, had been the operant word. "How bad is it, Darl? Really?"
"Lisi. Hun."
Lisi realized with alarm, and a further sinking in her vital parts, that her older sister was struggling with tears.
"Darla, take a deep breath and tell me."
"I'm okay. I just...
it's been a long day."
"When does Matt get back from Montreal?"
"Week after next. Don't even think about asking me to call him either. He's earning our trip to St. Bart's next winter, and he's not to be disturbed. We can handle this ourselves."
"Can we?"
"Definitely."
"Then tell me what it is we're supposed to be handling."
"Okay, right."
Lisi heard Darla take a breath.
"The cuts on her upper arms were shallow. Band-aid stuff. The ones on her thighs were deeper, and they'll scar. But they clotted over, thank God. No arterial shit."
Lisi?"
"What?
Just spit it out."
She'd almost told Darla to strap it on, which would have meant zip to her big sister. Whatever Darla had to tell her next, it was going to be something rotten. She could tell that by Darla's voice, which had been in and out of Lisi's ears from the cradle on. She tried to brace herself for it. She leaned back against the desk, her gaze shifted. And holy mother of God, there it was in the corner, leaning nonchalantly next to another stack of liquor store boxes, which were indeed labeled Scott, the early years. In the angle where the north wall met the east one was the silver spade from Nashville, big as Billy be damned. It was a blue-eyed wonder she hadn't seen it when she came in. Surely she would have if she hadn't been in a lather to grab the phone before the answering machine kicked in. She could read the words incised into the silver bowl from here. Commencement, Shipman Library. She could almost hear the southern fried chicken shit telling her husband that Tona would be writing it up for the year-end review and would he like a copy. And Scott replying,
"Lisi?"
Darla sounding really distressed for the first time, and Lisi returned to the present in a hurry. Of course Darla sounded distressed. Canty was in Boston for a week or maybe more, shopping while her husband took care of his wholesale auto business, buying program cars, auction cars, and off-lease rental cars in places like Malden and Lynn. Lynn, the city of sin. Darla's Matt, meanwhile, was in Canada, lecturing on the migration patterns of various North American Indian tribes. This, Darla had once told Lisi, was a surprisingly profitable venture. Not that money would help them now. Now it was down to just the two of them. To sister power.
"Lise? Did you hear me? Are you still the—"
"I'm here," Lisi said. "I just lost you for a few seconds, sorry. Maybe it's the phone. No one's used this one for a long time. It's downstairs in the barn.
What was going to be my office before Scott died?"
"Oh, yeah, sure."
Darla sounded completely mystified. "Has no smucking idea what I'm talking about," Lisi thought.
"Can you hear me now?"
"Clear as a bell." Looking at the silver spade as she spoke. Thinking of Gerd Allen Cole. Thinking, "I got to end all this ding-dong for the Freesias." Darla took a deep breath. Lisi heard it, like a wind blowing down the telephone line.
"She won't exactly admit it, but I think she, well, drank her own blood this time, Lise. Her lips and chin were all bloody when I got here, but nothing inside her mouth's cut. She looked the way we used to when Good Maud gave us one of her lipsticks to play with."
What Lisi flashed on wasn't those old dress-up and makeup days, those clunk-around in Good Ma's high-heel days, But that hot afternoon in Nashville, Scott lying on the pavement shivering, his lips smeared with candy-colored blood. Nobody loves a clown at midnight.
Listen, little Lisey, I'll make how it sounds when it looks around.
But in the corner the silver spade gleamed, and was it dented? She believed it was. If she ever doubted that she'd been in time, if she ever woke in the dark sweating, sure she'd been just a second too late and the remaining years of her marriage had consequently been lost.
Lisey, will you come? When she's in the clear, she's asking for you.
Alarm bells went off in Lisey's head.
What do you mean when she's in the clear? I thought you said she was okay.
She is. I think she is.
A pause.
She asked for you and asked for tea. I made her some and she drank it. That was good, wasn't it?
Yes, said Lisey.
Darl, do you know what brought this on?
Oh, you bet. I guess it's common chat around town, although I didn't know until Mrs. Jones told me over the phone.
What? But Lisey had a pretty good idea.
Charlie Corvo's back in town, Darla said, then lowering her voice.
Good old Shootin' Beans, everyone's favorite banker.
He brought a girl with him, a little French postcard from up in the St. John Valley.
She gave St. John Valley the main pronunciation, so it came out slurry lyrical, almost St. John. Lisey stood looking at the silver spade, waiting for the other shoe to drop. That there was another, she had no doubt.
They're married, Lisey, Darla said, and through the phone came a series of choked gurgles Lisey at first took for smothered sobs.
A moment later, she realized her sister was trying to laugh without being overheard by Amanda, who was God knew where in the house.
I'll be there as quick as I can, she said, and Darl?
No answer, just more of those choking noises, was what they sounded like over the phone. If she hears you laughing, the next one she takes the knife to is apt to be you. At that, the laughing sounds stopped. Lisey heard Darla taking a long, steadying breath.
Her shrink isn't around anymore, you know, Darla said at last. The Whitlow woman? The one who always wore the beads? She moved to Alaska, I think it was.
Lisey thought Montana, but it hardly mattered.
Well, we'll see how bad she is. There's the place Scott looked into. Greenlawn, up in the Twin Cities.
Oh, Lisey!
The voice of Goodma, the very voice.
Lisey what? She asked sharply. Lisey what?
Are you going to move in with her and keep her from carving Charlie Corvo's initials on her boobs the next time she goes Freak City? Or maybe you've got Canty tapped for the job.
Lisey, I didn't mean...
Or maybe Billy can come home from Tufts and take care of her? What's one more Dean's List student, more or less?
Lisey,
well, what are you proposing? She heard the hectoring tone in her voice and hated it. This was another thing money did to you after 10 or 20 years. Made you think you had the right to kick your way out of any tight corner you found yourself in. She remembered Scott saying that people shouldn't be allowed houses with more than 2 toilets to shit in. It gave them delusions of grandeur. She glanced at the shovel again. It gleamed at her. Calmed her.
You saved him, it said.
Not on your watch, it said.
Was that true?
She couldn't remember. Was it another of the things she'd forgotten on purpose? She couldn't remember that either.
What a hoot. What a bitter hoot.
Lisey, I'm sorry.
I know. What she knew was that she was tired and confused and ashamed of her outburst.
We'll work it out. I'll come right now, okay?
Yes. Relief in Darla's voice.
Okay.
That Frenchman, Lisey said, what a jerk. Good riddance to bad trash.
Get here as soon as you can.
I will. Goodbye. Lisey hung up. She walked over to the northeast corner of the room and grabbed the shaft of the silver spade. It was as if she were doing it for the first time. And was that so strange? When Scott passed it to her, she'd only been interested in the glittering silver scoop with its engraved message. And by the time she got ready to swing the darn thing, her hands had been moving on their own. Or so it had seemed. She supposed some primitive, survival-oriented part of her brain had actually been moving them for the rest of her, for thoroughly modern Lisey. She slid one palm down the smooth wood, relishing the smooth slide, and as she bent, her eyes once more fell on the 3 stacked boxes, with their exuberant message slashed across the side of each one in black magic marker.
Scott,
the early years. The box on top had once contained Gilby's gin, and the flaps had been folded together rather than taped. Lisi brushed away the dust, marveling at how thick it was, marveling at the realization that the last hands to touch this box, to fill it and fold the flaps and place it atop the others, now lay folded themselves and under the ground. The box was full of paper. Manuscripts, she presumed. The slightly yellowed title sheet on top was capitalized, underlined, and centered. Scott's name neatly typed beneath, also centered. All this she recognized as she would have recognized his smile. It had been his style of presentation when she met him as a young man and had never changed. What she didn't recognize was the title of this one, Ike Comes Home, by Scott Landon. Was it a novel? A short story? Just looking into the box, it was impossible to tell. But there had to be 1,000 or more pages in there, most of them in a single high stack under that title page, but still more crammed in sideways in 2 directions, like packing. If it was a novel, and this box contained all of it, it had to be longer than Gone with the Wind. Was that possible? Lisi supposed it might be. Scott always showed her his work when it was done, and he was happy to show her work in progress if she asked about it, a privilege he accorded no one else, not even his longtime editor, Carson Foray. But if she didn't ask, he usually kept it to himself. And he'd been prolific right up till the day he died. On the road or at home, Scott Landon wrote. But 1,000-pager? Surely he would have mentioned that. I bet it's only a short story, and one he didn't like at that. And the rest of the stuff in this box, the stuff underneath and crammed in at the side? Copies of his first couple of novels, probably. Or galley pages. What he used to call foul matter. But hadn't he shipped all the foul matter back to Pitt when he was done with it, for the Scott Landon collection in their library? For the incunks to drool over, in other words? And if there were copies of his early manuscripts in these boxes, how come there were more copies, carbons from the Dark Ages mostly, in the closets marked storage upstairs? And now that she thought about it, what about the cubbies on either side of the erstwhile chicken pen? What was stored in those? She looked upward, almost as if she were Supergirl and could see the answer with her X-ray vision, and that was when the telephone on her desk once more began to ring. 4. She crossed to the desk and snared the handset with a mixture of dread and irritation, but quite a bit heavier on the irritation. It was possible, just, that Amanda had decided to whack off an ear a la Van Gogh or maybe slit her throat instead of just a thigh or a forearm, but Lisi doubted it. All her life, Darla had been the sister most apt to call back 3 minutes later, starting off with, "I just remembered," or, "I forgot to tell you." "What is it, Darl?" There was a moment or two of silence, and then a male voice, one she thought she knew, said, "Mrs. Landon?" It was Lisi's turn to pause as she ran through a list of male names. Pretty short list these days. It was amazing how your husband's death pruned your catalog of acquaintances. There was Jacob Montano, their lawyer in Portland. Arthur Williams, the accountant in New York who wouldn't let go of a dollar until the eagle shrieked for mercy or died of asphyxiation. Deke Williams, no relation to Arthur, the contractor from Bridgeton who turned the empty haylofts over the barn into Scott's study and who'd also remodeled the second floor of their house, transforming previously dim rooms into wonderlands of light. Smiley Flanders, the plumber from over in Motton with the endless supply of jokes both clean and dirty. Charlie Haddonfield, Scott's agent, who called on business from time to time, foreign rights and short story anthologies mostly. Plus the handful of Scott's friends who still kept in touch. But none of those people would call on this number, surely, even if it were listed. Was it? She couldn't remember. In any case, none of the names seemed to fit how she knew or thought she knew the voice. But damn it. Mrs. Landon? "Who is this?" she asked. "My name doesn't matter, Mrs.," the voice replied. And Lisi had a sudden vivid image of Gerd Allen Cole, his lips moving in what might have been a prayer, except for the gun in his long-fingered poet's hand. "Dear God, don't let this be another one of those," she thought. "Don't let it be another Blondie." Yet she saw she once more had the silver spade in her hand. She'd grasped its wooden shaft without thinking when she picked up the phone, and that seemed to promise her that it was. "It matters to me," she said, and was astounded at her businesslike tone of voice. How could such a brisk, no-nonsense sentence emerge from such a suddenly dry mouth? And then, whoomp, just like that, where she'd heard the voice before came to her, that very afternoon, on the answering machine attached to this very phone. And it was really no wonder she hadn't been able to make the connection right away, because then the voice had only spoken 3 words. "I'll try again." "You identify yourself this minute, or I'm going to hang up." There was a sigh from the other end. It sounded both tired and good-natured. "Don't make this hard on me, missus. I'm trying to help you. I really am." Lisey thought of the dusty voices from Scott's favorite movie, The Last Picture Show. She thought again of Hank Williams singing Jambalaya, "Dress in style, go hog wild, me oh my oh." She said, "I'm hanging up now, goodbye, have a nice life." Although she did not so much as stir the phone from her ear, not yet. "You can call me Zack, missus. That's as good a name as any. All right?" "Zack what?" "Zack McCool." "Uh-huh, and I'm Liz Taylor." "You wanted a name, I gave you one." He had her there. "And how did you get this number, Zack?" "Directory assistance." So it was listed. That explained that. Maybe. "Now, will you listen for a minute?"
"I'm listening."
Listening, and gripping the silver spade, and waiting for the wind to change. Maybe that most of all. Because a change was coming. Every nerve in her body said so. "Mrs. There was a man came see you a while ago to have a look through your late husband's papers. And may I say I'm sorry for your loss." Lisey ignored this last. "Lots of people have asked me to let them look through Scott's papers since he died." She hoped the man on the other end of the line wouldn't be able to guess or intuit how hard her heart was now beating. "I've told them all the same thing. Eventually, I'll get around to sharing them with..."
"This fella's from your late husband's old college, missus. He says he is the logical choice, since these papers are apt to wind up there anyway."
For a moment, Lisey said nothing. She reflected on how her caller had pronounced husband, almost husband, as though Scott had been some exotic breakfast treat, now consumed. How he called her missus. Not a Maine man, not a Yankee, and probably not an educated man, at least in the sense Scott would have used the word. She guessed that Zack McCool had never been to college. She also reflected that the wind had indeed changed. She was no longer scared. What she was, at least for the time being, was angry. More than angry. Pissed like a bear. In a low, choked voice she hardly recognized, she said,
"Woodbody, that's who you're talking about, isn't it? Joseph Woodbody, that incunk son of a bitch."
There was a pause on the other end. Then her new friend said,
"I'm not following you, missus."
Lisey felt her rage come all the way up, and she welcomed it.
"I think you're following me fine. Professor Joseph Woodbody, king of the incunks, hired you to call and try and scare me into...
what?
Just turning over the keys to my husband's study? So he can go through Scott's manuscripts and take what he wants? Is that what... does he really think..."
She pulled herself down. It wasn't easy. The anger was bitter, but it was sweet, too, and she wanted to trip on it.
"Just tell me, Zack.
Yes or no?
Are you working for Professor Joseph Woodbody?"
"That's none of your business, missus."
Lisey couldn't reply to this. She was struck dumb, at least temporarily, by the sheer effrontery of it. What Scott might have called the perfectly huge, none-of-your-business ludicrosity of it.
"And nobody hired me to try and do nothing."
A pause.
"Anything, I mean. Now, missus, you want to close your mouth and listen. Are you listening to me?"
She stood with the telephone's receiver curled against her ear, considering that, "Are you listening to me?" and said nothing.
"I can hear you breathing, so I know you are." "That's good. When I'm hired, missus, this mother's son don't try. He does. I know you don't know me, but that's your disadvantage, not mine. This isn't just brag. I don't try, I do. You are gonna give this man what he wants, all right? He is gonna call me on the telephone or email me in this special way we have and say, everything's okay, I got what I want. If it doesn't happen in a certain run of time, I'm gonna come to where you are, and I'm gonna hurt you. I'm gonna hurt you places you didn't let the boys to touch at the junior high dances.
Lisa had closed her eyes at some point during this lengthy speech, which had the feel of a memorized set piece. She could feel hot tears trickling down her cheeks, and didn't know if they were tears of rage or shame. Could they actually be tears of shame? Yes, there was something shameful in being talked to like this by a stranger. It was like being in a new school and getting scolded by the teacher on your first day.
Smuck that, baby love, Scott said. You know what to do.
Sure she did. In a situation like this, you either strapped it on or you didn't. She'd actually never been in a situation like this, but it was still pretty obvious.
Missus, do you understand what I just told you?
She knew what she wanted to say to him, but he might not understand. So Lisa decided to settle for the more common usage.
Zack, speaking very low.
Yes, missus.
He immediately fell into the same low tone, what he perhaps took for one of mutual conspiracy.
Can you hear me?
You're a bit low pitch, but yes, missus.
She pulled air deep into her lungs, held it for a moment, imagining this man who said missus and husband and doesn't for doesn't. Imagined him with the telephone screwed tightly against his ear, straining toward the sound of her voice. When she had the picture clearly in the forefront of her mind, she screamed into that ear with all her force.
Then go fuck yourself.
Lisa slammed the phone back into the cradle hard enough to make dust fly up from the handset. 5. The telephone began to ring again almost immediately, but Lisa had no interest in further conversation with Zack McCool. She suspected that any chance of having what the TV talking heads called a dialogue was gone. Not that she wanted one. Nor did she want to listen to him on the answering machine and find out if he'd lost that tone of weary good nature and now wanted to call her a bitch, a cunt, or a coos. She traced the telephone cord back to the wall, the plate was close to that stack of liquor store boxes, and yanked the jack. The phone fell silent halfway through the third ring. So much for Zack McCool, at least for the time being. She might have doings with him later, she supposed, or about him, but right now there was Manda to deal with. Not to mention Darla, waiting for her and counting on her. She'd just go back to the kitchen, grab her car keys off the peg, and she'd take 2 minutes to lock the house up as well, a thing she didn't always bother with in the daytime. The house and the barn, and the study. Yes, especially the study, although she was damned if she'd capitalize it the way Scott had done, like it was some extra special big deal. But speaking of extra special big deals, she found herself looking into the top box again. She hadn't closed the flaps, so looking in was easy to do. Ike Comes Home by Scott Landon. Curious, and this would after all only take a second, Lisa leaned the silver spade against the wall, lifted the title page, and looked beneath. On the second sheet was this. Ike came home with a boom, and everything was fine.
Bool! The end!
Nothing else. Lisa looked at it for nearly a minute, although God knew she had things to do and places to go. Her skin was prickling again, but this time the feeling was almost pleasant. And hell, there really was no almost about it, was there? A small, bemused smile was playing around her mouth. Ever since she'd begun the work of cleaning out his study, ever since she'd lost it and trashed what Scott had been pleased to call his memory nook, if you wanted to be exact, she had felt his presence, but never as close as this, never as actual. She reached into the box and thumbed through a deep thickness of the pages stacked there, pretty sure of what she would find, and did. All the pages were blank. She rifled a bunch of the ones crammed in sideways, and they were too. In Scott's childhood lexicon, a boom had been a short trip, and a bool